Welcome to Oncology Today, key presentations from the 2024 American Society of Hematology Annual Meeting on Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Lindsay Roker from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, to discuss relevant CLL datasets from ASH 2024. In addition to this interview, there's a slide presentation that highlights these abstracts, so check that out. This activity may include discussion of non-FDA-approved uses of agents, so please refer to prescribing information for more. Conflicts of interest statements can also be found in the program notes. To begin, I asked Dr. Roker about a new development in the management of CLL, the use of BTK degraders.
So the drugs overall seem to be well tolerated, and the safety profiles of these do look totally reasonable. So I've personally treated patients with both of these drugs and effective and tolerated well, and I think it's going to be an exciting class. I think we're learning more and more about how BTK has not only its kinase activity, which, you know, is important for the cell signaling for continued, you know, growth and survival of cells, but also has kind of these scaffolding effects. So there are other proteins that are docking into BTK, and potentially by degrading the protein altogether, we can really eliminate that element of BTK activity.
So when you say well-tolerated, what about some of the issues that come up with BTK inhibitors, even in quality of life, you know, cardiac, arthralgias, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, overall, these drugs are incredibly well tolerated. So in terms of safety, in the Beijing study, they didn't see any atrial fibrillation. The rates of major bleeding were 3.3%. Febrile neutropenia was under 2%. Most common toxicities high grade were neutropenia at 21% and pneumonia at 8%. So some infectious complications that you would expect in this patient population, heavily relapse refractory, and then few cardiac issues.
It's funny how we can talk about things for years, and yet I still think of questions I never thought to ask people. And I'm still kind of thinking a little bit about pathophysiology. So like, it sounds like BTK is a critical pathway in CLL. What about in normal cells?
So there seems to be this increased dependence on the B cell receptor in CLL cells and B cell receptor signaling through BTK. And that seems to be really crucial to the survival of these cells. I think based on what we're seeing, there are off-target effects. So the cardiovascular toxicity, the bleeding toxicity, I think we're learning that, those effects are real, but we don't see the B cell depletion with BTK inhibitors and degraders in the same way we do with CD20. So there, that BTK dependence in normal B cells is seemingly not as significant as it is for CLL cells.
All right. Well, I'm going to start going through the papers in the order that you had them, because they really seem to tell us a great story. So I'm curious, one of the papers you talked about looked at acalabrutinib in the so-called very elderly. It was defined here greater than 80. And I wonder if you could sort of summarize your take on what they saw, what other data has shown in the same population, and how that lines up with what you actually see in your own practice in these older patients.
Yeah. So I think some of the background here that led to this study is that back in 2019, when we saw all of the ibrutinib studies come out showing that it was better than chemoimmunotherapy, there were some early deaths with ibrutinib, sudden cardiac deaths, specifically in very old patients. So I think with that, there was concern that perhaps this is not a safe approach for the very elderly. Then we had the second generation BTK inhibitors, acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, that have been compared head-to-head with ibrutinib in the relapse refractory setting and showed improved safety profiles. So the question here is, should we be worried about using these drugs in our patients who have, the who are those older patients or more frail. And the take-home message from these data are these drugs are safe. And that's been my experience as well. I think a lot of times, especially in older patients, disease-related symptoms are significant. And by eliminating some of those, we can actually see reversal of some of the frailty that we are not necessarily sure at the beginning if it's disease, if it's age, you know, where that's really coming from. And this suggests that for at least a subset of older patients, that frailty is really driven by disease. And by getting better disease control, we're able to kind of improve people's quality of life. And it seems to be a safe approach.
Yeah, I mean, of course, people have concerns about ventricular arrhythmias and sudden death. Interesting, they had one out of 53 patients with sudden death. What about ventricular arrhythmias? Do you see that?
So I have seen cases, and there, you know, it's now in the FDA label for ibrutinib. And then with acalabrutinib, there have been some reports that this has been observed as well. So I think it is a risk. It's something that I talk to my patients about is like, if you're developing palpitations, if you're developing chest pressure, any of those things, you need to be urgently evaluated. Now, obviously, sudden cardiac death is a little trickier because there's not a lot of intervention when it's sudden. But, you know, I think being on the lookout for it is important. And I think we are still learning more about who these patients are that are at highest risk of this. And I'm hopeful that at some point we'll have you know, better tools to assess what are the baseline features that put patients at highest risk so that we can really be informed as we're counseling patients and using these drugs.
Yeah, I mean, to me, like one sudden death out of 53 is kind of encouraging in this population. Mm-hmm. You know, another thing, and I've seen this in other studies, I don't really have a good feel, and I don't know whether oncologists do or not, for the frailty index. I think most people obviously know about performance status. But this study looked at, quote, frailty index and also showed an improvement, which I thought is really interesting. I assume that was, I guess, disease-related symptomatology?
So the frail index is, it's basically looking at the number of deficits a patient has, and that allows you to basically calculate their index. And it's a really long list. So it's age-related health deficits, chronic diseases, functional limitation, cognitive impairment. So it's kind of a comprehensive look versus just performance status, which I think we often think of as being more disease-related. This is a bit more comprehensive in that look. And I think that we're learning more and more about how important frailty is. And, you know, the SIRS score has been used in a lot of studies to define kind of comorbid patients. But I think that doesn't really tell us the whole story. There's the functional limitations that we need to take into account as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the word frail kind of, you know, gives you an idea in general or a picture. But then for me, trying to get more specific is a little challenging. So, for example, these patients had a frailty score minimum of 3. Can you, like, describe a typical patient who might, you know, what you would see when they walk in the office?
So the frail index of 3 means that they're basically pre-frail or at risk for frailty. That's the cutoff point that we're using there. Now, in terms of what that means, I think it tends to be somebody with comorbid conditions that are putting them at risk, with, you know, functional limitations that are putting them at risk, but not kind of that, you know, cachectic, really end of life type picture that we maybe have when we use the word frail. So this is kind of looking at even patients that are a little bit before, that are before that.
So I also want to ask you about your study, which I think is really fascinating, looking at venetoclax obinutuzumab in terms of MRD. Can you summarize what you saw there and how you think it would translate to clinical practice? Have you changed your practice because of it, for example?
Yeah, so what this is showing is for patients who are early deep responders, you can shorten the duration of venetoclax and not significantly impact progression-free survival. So you can have kind of less venetoclax exposure with the associated lower rates of toxicity, and that doesn't impact overall progression-free survival. I think one of the interesting pieces to come out of this is that the number of patients here who were MRD detectable at the end of a year is small. It was 3 patients reported at this data cut. But that second year of venetoclax doesn't seem to uniformly deepen responses. So I think that question about should we just keep going with venetoclax, this would suggest that we actually need to probably pause and really be thoughtful about that, because that second year of therapy might allow, you know, might just expose patients to more toxicity without actually deepening responses. So maybe for those people who aren't kind of achieving that deep response, the right answer is an intensification approach rather than just continuation of the current therapy. In terms of the question of have I changed my clinical practice, I still, when I'm using Ven as kind of a standard of care, still use it per label, but I do think that there is value in MRD at the end of therapy for predicting and prognosticating for patients. So I do get MRD at the end of standard of care venetoclax and obinutuzumab as a prognostic tool. I think it's close to prime time. I think that will be one of the changes that come in the next few years, especially since some of the upcoming studies that we're going to have that are going to be truly practice changing. So one that comes to mind is the MAGIC study, which is looking at acalabrutinib and venetoclax versus venetoclax and obinutuzumab. So doublet versus doublet, which is better. Both of those use MRD-adapted approaches. So there, it's almost like the standard of care arm is MRD-adapted venetoclax. And I think that is going to be the way the field moves.
What is the prognosis of patients who are MRD positive after a year?
It's a great question. So at the end of venetoclax and obinutuzumab, that MRD status really does predict progression-free survival. So at 3 years after last treatment exposure, those with uMRD at end of treatment had an overall survival of 92.2% after ven-obin compared with those with detectable MRD, which was 72.7%. So there's a survival benefit there. So what we've learned from CLL14 is that there's a huge distinction between those who achieve undetectable MRD and those who do not, both in terms of progression-free survival. And then looking at the overall survival rate 3 years after completing therapy, those who achieved undetectable MRD have an overall survival rate of 92% versus 73% for those who are still detectable. So a big split between those groups.
So in that regard, I'm curious about your further thoughts on this H0158 study, where they started out with the ibrutinib venetoclax, and then if they're MRD positive, they switched to venetoclax and obinutuzumab.
Correct? Yeah, intensified. Yep, exactly. So that study is interesting in that we know that MRD status really does predict progression-free survival with ven-obin. In the GLOW study, the proportion of patients who achieved undetectable MRD was about 40%, and patients did very, very well regardless of their MRD status. So whether or not they had achieved undetectable MRD, their progression-free survival was great. And that's kind of an interesting piece because here we're intensifying, and I think intensification is a very reasonable approach. I think we just need to figure out which patients actually need intensification, and it's possible that the BTK-BCL2 doublet patients might not require that, but this is showing that for patients who have received that I plus V combo and have not achieved undetectable MRD, adding in another mechanism, so the addition of obinutuzumab, can induce deeper responses for a subset.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty big jump. I think you said it was like 21% to 60%.
So 21% were still were undetectable after the I plus V. And then of those who were detectable and then received more therapy, 60% of those were then uMRD. So 60% of those highest risk patients.
So even though I hear everybody say MRD is prognostic, I'm still not exactly sure how prognostic it is, because if you really believe that it's such a critical issue, would you then conclude that it would, you know, kind of the AVO strategy makes more sense? I mean, it's a, the only thing that's different is the obinutuzumab. And that bumps up, and you, and that kind of makes sense. I mean, that's believable to me. It's a very effective drug. Does that kind of make you think more that a triplet, we'll get to Amplify next, the concept of a triplet makes more sense and going to be more effective?
I think that triplets induce higher rates of undetectable MRD. I think that that probably is true. Now, the effective question and the long-term, you know, efficacy piece also has to take into account the safety. And I think Amplify nicely demonstrated that that infectious risk is real. These are people who, even outside of COVID-19, are at risk for infections. And I think we are seeing more and more that the third drug does add in toxicity. So, you know, I think that there is a subset of patients for whom the triplet is going to be a very reasonable approach, where that PFS really is important and probably the infectious risk is a bit lower. But I think for a lot of patients, that triplet approach might not be necessary. We might be able to get away with kind of the sequential doublet or single novel agent approaches.
Yeah, so that does lead into the Amplify study. And just to continue that discussion, I guess one thing that's very dramatic about Amplify is it was done in the middle of the pandemic. A lot of patients weren't even vaccinated. It was before the vaccine for a lot of these patients, and they had a lot of COVID deaths, particularly in the triplet arm. But what other types of infections were seen beyond COVID?
The neutropenia risk is there, and any infection was high grade for a quarter of patients with AVO versus 12% with AV. So that was not only a COVID, but kind of all comer infections, the pneumonias, the, you know, the infections you would expect.
So let's talk a little bit about your take on Amplify. I can remember when I first saw the abstract, I was like, wow, this is going to be interesting. And it certainly has turned out to be the case. As you and your colleagues have sort of sorted through the data over the last 3 months and thought about it, how theoretically would you like to apply it to your practice? Would you want to give it? Would you give one of those two arms to pretty much everybody? Or are there other patients where you would prefer, you know, a single agent BTK or Van-O-Bin? What's your current preference and thoughts?
So I think there are a couple pieces here. The first is the data, the long-term data for CLL14 as a fixed duration regimen are still show us that there are these patients who achieve undetectable MRD and have prolonged benefit from a single novel agent approach. So my sense is that when there's a lot of bulky disease, a subset for whom CLL14 maybe has some limitations, perhaps the BTK-containing doublet is really appealing. There's also the logistical pieces of this. So an all-oral doublet versus the infusional piece is a big difference in terms of patient experience. So I think there's that element. And I think that we're going to continue to have more and more data that's going to help us figure out who should be receiving which regimen. I think there are a couple pieces here. The mutated IGHV outcomes for the doublet versus triplet look excellent. And for that subgroup of patients who want an all-oral regimen, definitely AV is the way I would go rather than AVO. For others who are looking for an all-oral regimen, I think AV is, especially if there's bulky disease, a very reasonable strategy. The addition of obinutuzumab, I think, is going to be for more selected younger patients who really want to maximize that PFS piece and have a lower risk of infection.
Yeah, that phrase, patients who want an all-oral regimen, is kind of stuck in my head a little bit, because I guess I'm trying to think about who would not fit into that category.
I mean, I think that time in the clinic has weighs differently on different people. There are people where that isn't, you know, as much of a burden, and there are people where that definitely is more of a burden. So I think that You know, it's making our discussions about frontline therapy that have historically been long, even when it was just BTK inhibitors versus Van-Oben, even longer in terms of, you know, what is the right approach for the patient in front of us.
So again, kind of assuming access to all these options, I'm curious, like, who would you give VO to?
So I think VO is still a very reasonable strategy for patients when there's non-bulky disease. It's a really tricky question. So part of the caveat is that our clinical trial portfolio right now is looking at pirtobrutinib and venetoclax in the frontline setting. So I've been steering people that direction quite a bit. But in terms of that standard of care approach, I think that Van-Oben has longer term data, both in terms of efficacy and safety. And I think that there is some comfort in that piece. I think we, you know, had a lot of data from I plus V in terms of reassurance that these fixed duration all oral regimens are allowing for retreatment down the road without development of resistance mutations. But obviously, that's still somewhat of an open question, especially with a different regimen. So I think the long-term data of Van-Oben is reassuring, and there are a lot of people for whom that piece really is helpful. But the all-oral regimen is definitely appealing for a lot of people, and why this is kind of you know, becoming an exciting regimen. I think until we have head-to-head data with the MAGIC study, it's going to be really tricky to know which is actually better.
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of curious what you think if you had to predict what the MAGIC study is going to show. I don't know how big it is. It seems like hard to predict, you know, envision a treatment benefit, but I definitely could see a difference in terms of quality of life, you know, patient-reported outcomes. What do you think it's going to show?
I'm not a betting woman, Neil. I think that the data are going to be highly informative, and I think that both of these regimens are incredibly effective.
In your own experience, how would you indirectly compare quality of life and the patient experience with those two options?
With both of them, the venetoclax dose ramp is probably the part that is most intensive for patients. So with Van-Oben, it's 9 weeks of 1 to 2 visits a week versus with acalabrutinib venetoclax, it's the 5-week dose escalation and it's coming months down the road. So there's definitely more upfront investment with Van-Oben, just with the addition of the infusions at the beginning, plus that cycle 3 infusion. I think the toxicity profiles are going to be a little bit different. I think the infectious risk is there with both regimens. I also think that with longer time, with longer follow-up and things like that, understanding what those longer-term infectious risks are going to be is important, because Oben definitely causes more B-cell depletion. And are we, as a consequence, seeing longer-term infectious risk? I think all of those things are going to be important.
What about this phase 2 study that was presented at ASH by the Dana-Farber group, Matt Davids et al., looking at AVO in higher-risk patients? How does that compare indirectly to other data in highly similar population, particularly BTK alone?
Yeah, so BTK alone, the outcomes longer-term with single-agent continuous BTK inhibitors look really good. I think that all that being said, the time where a patient with high-risk disease is going to have the best shot at a treatment-free interval is probably after the first-line therapy. So I think that kind of figuring out the way to maximize efficacy for those patients so that they might achieve a time where they really do have treatment-free observation and that's a meaningful time is important. So I think the AVO data they look great. It's a very high-risk patient population, and the progression-free survival curves really, you know, over 5 years don't look bad. it's also a very different experience to get a year of therapy and then have 4 years of, you know, treatment-free observation than it is to be on continuous BTK inhibitors. So I think the patient experience is different. And I do think that optimizing kind of this frontline treatment so that patients can have the longest possible treatment-free duration, potentially saving that continuous BTK inhibitor for, you know, the second line setting is not a bad approach.
So I'm also curious about your thoughts on this sonrotoclax and zanubrutinib trial, particularly sonrotoclax. I mean, it's always difficult to compare indirectly, but it looked like they had really good outcomes there. Any theoretical reason to think whether sonrotoclax would be more or less effective than venetoclax?
Yeah, so sonrotoclax and venetoclax are very similar drugs. I think the difference here is that this is a continuous exposure. So these people are getting a doublet, but it's not time limited. So I think it's really important to interpret the data with that in mind.
So let's talk a little bit about pirtobrutinib. Of course, you talked about the big phase 3 study, Bruin CLL 321. Where right now do you see pirtobrutinib being used, the optimal timing of introduction of pirtobrutinib?
So it's a great question and one that I think is really remains to be seen. I think the progression-free survival here of 14 months is notably different than the median time to next treatment, which was about 2 years. So we're seeing that patients, even at progression, are having sustained benefit after that. And then there's also the question of, does venetoclax come before this or does it come after this? And I think the data that we have don't really give us enough to answer that question, because from the Bruin study, we were seeing that patients who had been, you know, not previously venetoclax exposed had a longer duration of response, although you're also just treating somebody who's had fewer lines of therapy. So I think that that's kind of to be expected. So I think in terms of, you know, should this come right after a covalent BTK inhibitor versus should it wait until that double refractory setting, we don't really have the data to guide us there. I do think that there are patients for whom, you know, they've been on a covalent BTK inhibitor. They like the idea of being on a continuous pill with progression or with disease control. And I think for those patients, using pirtobrutinib in that setting is not necessarily wrong. But I think that we don't really know yet.
You know, it's also always difficult to get, you know, a more granular feel for tolerability of new agents just based on data you see in a paper. Of course, we've been hearing about the great tolerability of pirtobrutinib ever since it first came out. But you have the challenge of indirect comparison. Do you think treatment discontinuation is less frequent with pirtobrutinib than, you know, say, second-generation covalent inhibitors? Do you have enough experience yourself to have a feel? I mean, do you think you can see a difference clinically? Is it that noticeable? And in what way? Is it cardiac? Is it quality of life? You know, any more sort of insights?
Yeah. So it's a very well-tolerated drug. I think from my experience treating patients with pirtobrutinib, it's incredibly well-tolerated. In terms of comparison to covalent BTK inhibitors, it's a tough question because you're using them in different contexts. People who are receiving pirtobrutinib, by definition, have been through more therapies, have more comorbidities from their prior therapies. Like, all of those pieces are different. So I think that any clinical comparison is in such different contexts that it's hard to even know what to make of that. All that being said, the reported rates of cardiovascular toxicity are very low. In the phase 1/2, as well as in this study, the rates of bleeding are low. The rates of high grade infection are relatively low. So it's overall a very well tolerated drug, and I think that's very true.
You know, of course, it's intriguing that pirtobrutinib causes responses in people who progress on prior BTK covalent BTK. Do you have the sense that it has more activity And or do, also, do you think that maybe there's less treatment discontinuation and in that way it contributes to efficacy as well? The patients stay on therapy more?
Great questions. In terms of the mechanisms of pirtobrutinib, so pirtobrutinib works in a couple of ways. There's a non-covalent BTK inhibition, which is, you know, basically, you don't need the binding site that you need for a covalent BTK inhibitor to work. So even when that mutation, resistance mutation has developed at the binding site, you still have basically kinase inhibition. There's also a scaffolding effect of pirtobrutinib. So it seems to change the conformation of BTK, which before we had talked a little bit about the scaffolding effect, it seems to prevent downstream signaling because of that. So there seem to be a couple different mechanisms by which it's working. In terms of the discontinuation rate, yes, the discontinuation rate is very low because of the tolerability of the drug, and drugs work better when they're inside of people. So I think that is definitely a good point that we're seeing a lot of the sustained benefit because people are able to tolerate the drug and stay on it.
So we were talking about AVO, but you also discussed a paper on PVO, so pirtobrutinib, venetoclax, obinutuzumab. Again, looked like really great results. Do you see pirtobrutinib landing?
MRD results,
Incredible.
100% is hard to beat. So
you can't beat 100%. Do you see pirtobrutinib landing in first-line therapy?
It's a great question. It's being explored there. We have a study open. This study has been ongoing. I think that it is interesting, right? If we look at the paradigm from other diseases where some of the drugs that used to be used for relapse refractory disease but are better tolerated, more targeted, et cetera, end up earlier in the treatment paradigm, I think this has potential to be one of those, particularly as a time-limited therapy. We don't want to be inducing resistance with continuous exposure, but in a time-limited capacity, especially because the tolerability is so good and it pairs nicely with other drugs, I think there is good rationale for examining it in this setting.
So I want to get into CAR-T. You talked about a paper from ASH looking at liso-cel plus the ibrutinib. Maybe you can comment on that and the rationale in that situation for using ibrutinib. And we'll move that after you go through that into your current approach to double refractory disease. But what about this paper looking at CAR-T plus BTK?
So the major take-home here is that the CR rate is a lot higher when you use ibrutinib in combination with liso-cel than it is with liso-cel alone. And that's important because achieving CR does seem to be really important with cellular therapy. So those are the patients who have these durable responses. And I think the importance of that really is there. So, you know, you're both getting better disease control, but you're also getting better T-cell fitness with adding in the BTK inhibitor. So I think that with this, we're learning that that's an important partner for cellular therapy. In terms of the approach to relapse refractory disease, double refractory disease, so typically when patients are kind of in that third line setting, so they've progressed on a BTK inhibitor and they're resistant to venetoclax, I think that is a very appropriate time to be thinking about CAR-T and where that's going to fall in the treatment paradigm. The nice piece is now we have pirtobrutinib as a bridge to CAR-T, and I've been using that approach where, you know, we're getting a response with a bridge and then able to go into cellular therapy from there.
Any evidence or any thoughts about whether we will see or have seen evidence of cure with CAR-T with CLL in terms of plateau the way we see with diffuse large B-cell, for example?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think you know, there was a New York Times article talking about patients who had been treated, 10 plus years ago with CAR-T and had, you know, been, quote unquote cured from their CLL. And that led to a lot of people being excited coming into clinic saying, like, how are you going to cure me? I'm still very hesitant to use the phrase cure with this disease. I think that we can see durable remissions. I also think that this is a chronic disease where we have niches of cells that eventually grow out. So, you know, we're developing all of these tools to make it a very manageable chronic disease. And, you know, I think the goal of cure is certainly noble and really important for certain very young patients. But for most of our patients, I think that we have tools to allow them kind of very, very good survival with management of a chronic disease.
So what about CRS and ICANS with CAR T? I mean, Lysocell is known to be, you know, better tolerated, but it kind of looked like there's a pretty significant amount of CRS. What do you see in CLL patients?
So both with CLL as well as with the bispecific T-cell engagers, CRS is real. And part of that might just be the overall disease burden. They tend to be older patients. So I think that that risk is a bit higher. So I think that some of the strategies being used to mitigate that risk, for instance, the EPCOR data that we looked at that have that step-up dosing, I think that that is important as we figure out how to use these drugs well, not just in academic settings, but also in community settings, because CRS is obviously tricky to manage and can be limiting in the use of these drugs.
I'm kind of curious how many patients have you sent to CAR T in the last year, roughly?
Probably two handfuls. And I have a practice that is all CLL. So, you know, I have a bias, obviously. But, you know, patients who are coming for a clinical trial consideration, I think that discussing CAR T and having them meet with a CAR T team is an important piece of this.
You mentioned epcoritamab, and those data look pretty good. Any thoughts about indirectly comparing bispecifics to CAR T and CLL?
Great question. I think that the data with bispecifics do look good. Over time, you know, I think a lot of patients are going to have a bispecific first because it is a lot easier in terms of just you don't need the cell manufacturing, all these things. So I think part of the tricky piece of CAR T is the data we have available are from patients who are heavily relapse refractory. And it's hard to know how to optimally use something when it's always being relegated to the last line. So I think that with time, looking at CAR T earlier in earlier lines of therapy, as well as looking at bispecifics in earlier lines of therapy, because we know that some of the T cell dysfunction that develops over time probably allows for less efficacy of bispecific T cell engagers. So potentially using these drugs earlier is the wave of the future. But I think we, you know, have a lot of work to do before we can say that.
So I guess we didn't see any groundbreaking papers at ASH on Richter's transformation, but I would be curious what your thoughts are on that. I also see you've done some work looking at Richter's in patients who've not had prior chemoimmunotherapy. I'm curious how they compare to people who have Richter's after chemoimmunotherapy. Also, something you've looked at, I'm curious what the update is in terms of pirtobrutinib for Richter's.
All good questions. The BTK degraders both have some patients with Richter's treated, and response rates there look actually reasonable. There's also been the previous data for EPCOR in Richter's transformation and looking at basically how effective that can be. So I think those are two reasonable, you know, additional tools in the future for Richter's transformation. In terms of understanding Richter's transformation in the era of modern therapies, I think what we've learned, there was a big real-world study led by Dr. Katai at Mount Sinai, and basically looking at outcomes for these patients. I think the answer is that Richter's remains a very serious condition with, you know, suboptimal therapeutic approaches in the current day. So really, I think, you know, the NCCN guidelines still have clinical trial enrollment as kind of a preferred first approach for Richter's because, you know, the classic chemoimmunotherapy approaches really have low response rates, and we're really trying to, you know, advance outcomes for these patients. So a plug for clinical trial enrollment for the patients who develop Richter's transformation.
What about the use of pirtobrutinib in Richter's and even in the community? I'm not sure whether you could even access it, but in a patient who had no other options or really wasn't fit enough for chemotherapy, for example, do you think pirtobrutinib is a reasonable thing to attempt to do?
Yeah, so the data on pirtobrutinib in Richter's transformation has been published, and it does look pretty good. So the response rates are fairly high. It doesn't seem to be particularly durable. So I think it is a really useful tool as a bridge to a more durable therapy. So I've had patients where this has been used as a bridge to transplant or a bridge to CAR T. I think as a single agent, it definitely affords time, some time, but it doesn't seem to be durable in most patients.
So here's a broader question I'm curious about. Obviously, there's been so much excitement about novel agents in CLL. But if you take a step back and think back to the era of chemoimmunotherapy, particularly BR, and compare it to patients nowadays, do you think people are living longer or destined to live longer? And do you think their quality of life is better? And in what way?
I think the quality of life thing, it's definitely better. So I think that these drugs are well tolerated. I think that the responses are more durable. So the time-limited therapies allow for longer time off therapy. We get disease control for longer. I think all of those things are a benefit. From a toxicity perspective, it's always interesting because our toxicity profile comparisons when it's continuous therapies versus time-limited chemoimmunotherapy don't account for the differences in exposure. So, for instance, that CLL-321, the comparison of pirtobrutinib versus BR, either BR or idelalisib rituximab, it's hard to interpret those data because the exposure to BR is significantly shorter than the exposure to a continuous pirtobrutinib. So I think interpreting safety profiles in that context is important. There are data suggesting that many patients with CLL have survivals that are at this point approaching age match controls. So I think we, are doing very well in this disease. I think there's a subset of patients who have kind of these more aggressive biologies, and for those patients, we need to figure out how to, kind of optimize approaches, and all of these targeted agents in the heavily relapse refractory arena are incredibly important. But I also think it's important that we, consider that a lot of these patients are going to have normal lifespans. So how do we prevent some of the morbidity associated with this disease? And what does that look like? I think those are future research directions that are important.
You know, it's really funny. Last night we did a webinar on prostate cancer. And I'm starting to think, and I don't know if you know much about what's going on there with prostate cancer, but we were talking about time-limited therapy of endocrine therapy in prostate cancer, which is they never did before in metastatic disease. And I was thinking how, in a way, it's in a weird way, it kind of reminds me of the paradigm that evolved in CLL, although obviously completely different disease. But from the point of view of the patient, the advantage of being off therapy is just so huge. Of course, there it's much more symptomatic. I'm curious, when you think back, over the last year or two, other than outside of patients with Richter's, what do people die of with CLL, particularly not, obviously, non-CLL related, but related to CLL? Do they die of infections? What do they die from?
Infections and second cancers are two major issues. So infections, both because of the underlying disease biology, as well as the, long-term implications of these therapies, we have immunosuppressed patients who are just at risk for bad infections. the second piece is there is that risk of second malignancies. So I talked to all of my patients about screening for non-melanoma skin cancers, screening for colon cancer, screening for prostate cancer, breast cancer, cervical cancer, all of the things that, you know, we should be doing anyway, but are particularly important for these patients as we're trying to, you know, minimize those second issues.
So final question, I'm curious, what are some of the ongoing trials that you're most excited about, trials that you're putting patients on and other trials? What are some of the new trials that are ongoing right now that you think are most exciting?
So I think in the frontline setting, understanding which time-limited combination is kind of going to lead to the longest progression-free survival is going to be a really important practice-informing piece. So the MAGIC study we had mentioned, there are a couple others looking at time-limited therapies comparisons. And I think those studies are really going to be informative. I think that these BTK degraders are important studies that are going to hopefully lead to FDA approval of these agents. And that's really going to be helpful for that subset of patients with those highly relapsed refractory diseases. In the relapse refractory setting, in terms of what is the best approach for kind of time-limited therapy, there's an ongoing ven-rituximab, so kind of the standard Murano regimen versus PVR, so pirtobrutinib, venetoclax, and rituximab, and figuring out how to optimize progression-free survival for patients in the relapse refractory setting with time-limited therapies, I think is going to be exciting. I think there's ongoing studies looking at CAR T. There's, alternate targets. There's off-the-shelf products. I think some of these approaches are going to be really important, again, for these heavily relapsed refractory patients.
Any biomarkers, though, that predict treatment benefit from either our existing agents or some of the new agents? In oncology in general, you see this all the time, but you have, mutated, non-mutated, but I mean more specific biomarkers of prediction or response to even BTK and venetoclax.
Great questions. I think we have kind of our basic prognostic factors. We know that TP53 aberration and unmutated IGHV, are higher risk features. In terms of looking at additional pieces, I think those data are all pretty early. In terms of other pieces, so cell-free DNA and looking at circulating tumor DNA, I think is going to be a forward-looking kind of approach because MRD tells a lot of the story, but not the entire story. So, that circulating disease in the blood from the bone marrow niche, I think, is incredibly important. But we're also seeing cases where there are nodal progressions and perhaps using other biomarkers to understand kind of the nodal disease burden is going to be an important piece of future directions too.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Roker, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today, key presentations on chronic lymphocytic leukemia from the 2024 ASH Annual Meeting.